1,000 miles all the way. I get your kick on Route 66. And I go through St.
Yes,
Louis, stop the Missouri,
Matt
and Oklahoma City. Look,
he is not our guest tonight. That was lovely to hear him again. But P.J. O'Rourke is, and P.J.'s newest book is Driving Like Crazy. You put aside all the direct political satire and all the direct indignation pieces that you've done for years so brilliantly, and instead you've done a kind of a nostalgic book here.
It is. Last year, when it became clear that the American automobile industry, as we knew it, was circling the drain, I thought, well, maybe this is a time. My publisher and I had talked about this before, and I said, maybe this is the time to do this. Car journalism has been a sideline of mine for more than 30 years, and I said, let's bring that stuff together. So I broke out my files. I keep all the old junk. You know, you never know when you're going to have to empty the files and put a book together. And I spread it all out, and I read through it, and it required a lot of rewriting. It wasn't one of these things where I could just slap it together. First place, I wanted to put an essay in at the beginning and at the end about the end of the American car industry. But also, I found that when I reread this stuff, it's buff journalism. A lot of it was written quickly. It was written about products that were very hot maybe at the moment, but that are now long forgotten. And I had to take out a lot of boring technical stuff. Some of the pieces were just plain badly written. I mean, they almost served as nothing more than a kind of a diary entries to write anew.
You find me, sir, and we've known each other for many years, still in a state of some bereavement over the loss of my last car.
Yes.
So for the last 2 months, regular listeners have been aware of this, I've been searching for a new car. And I may now announce that I purchased that new car only about 3 days ago. But the last car was a 1994 Buick LeSabre.
Great car.
I loved it.
Yeah.
I absolutely, and therefore I kept it forever. I put a new motor in it at some point. Somebody banged into it. I guess the insurance covered most of the restoration, but it took about $5,000 or $6,000 to restore.
Sure.
I would not let it go. It was large. It was capacious. It was a dark maroon or burgundy color.
Nice
it had
color.
Not the usual, the present bucket seats, but rather, whatever they call them, bench seats.
The old-fashioned bench seats
bench
you
seats
could slide right across.
With beautiful burgundy leather on
yeah.
it. I just loved that car.
Nothing
finally,
wrong with that.
It died on me.
And
I had to get rid of it. And then for the last 2 months, I have been driving rental cars while shopping. I was in a state of obsessive neurosis, or maybe obsessive psychosis.
What did you get, though? What did you buy?
I finally wound up with, I wonder how you will feel about this. I hereby announce, I got a used car.
Yeah.
Because I wanted something with some luxury, and I didn't want to spend $50,000
no.
on it. So I got a 2005 Lexus E300, I think it's called.
A good car?
Same color, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
What finally sold me on it after my fourth visit to the Lexus place, McGrath Lexus in Chicago. They're not paying for this, but I hereby announce it. And my salesman, Gary Sowell, was very patient with me as I kept turning up and never buying anything. But finally, I dropped in on him just a few days ago, and there was yet another Lexus. It looked good, and it had the same color almost as my old Buick. And that
well,
turned
Lexus
the deal.
It's kind of the modern Japanese Buick. You know, it's a good, solid.
But it's bucket seats. It doesn't have.
It's his bucket seats. It's
and
very
it's
hard
kind
to
of
find.
Tight in the back. It reminds you of a Chicago taxi cab in the back.
That's right. Yeah, they don't make them like they used to for purposes that we needn't name on radio, the things that could be done back there.
Yeah.
But Lexus is essentially the old, it's the Buick. It's a luxurious without being too luxurious, you know, without being ostentatious, kind of a quiet car, well built. I have nothing against the Japanese cars. I do find them to be a bit lacking in personality.
Well, you have a great love affair with them. It shows up in this book all over the place with all the great old American cars.
Well, not just American, actually. I'm crazy about a lot of different kind of cars, even including Italian cars.
Uh-huh.
But I do have a big love affair with cars. There's no doubt about that.
And you write about cars which are long since gone and gone away. Of course, right now we are talking, we're sort of at the graveside, aren't we, when it comes to the classic American car?
I fear so. I really dislike the extent of government intervention in this very important American industry. Now, this has been growing apace, this government intervention, for since the early 70s. We're talking about almost 40 years now that the government has been involving itself with the automobile, always with the best of intentions, always about things you can never really argue with the government. Oh, we should make them safer. Oh, we should make it so that when they bump into things at low speeds, it doesn't hurt them or the other car. Oh, they should be cleaner in their emissions, and so on and so forth. But the net result has been basically a power grab, enormous government regulation of an industry.
Well, our friendly uncle, the state, has been intervening for some time in many of the basic pleasures of our lives, including what we eat, including what, if anything, we smoke.
That's right.
Including just about everything. And now they have indeed, with our new uncle, they've gotten around to cars.
Yes. And the result has been terrible. One of the things that made cars so appealing to so many generations of American kids, particularly boys, was that you could mess with them. You could tinker with them. Mm-hmm. They were not only were they a passport to freedom and independence, but they also were something to do. They were a hobby. But you might as well pry the back off an iPod as open the hood of a modern car.
Can't be understood is what you
can't
mean.
Be understood. It can't be understood without a degree.
Is it understood by the mechanics?
No. It very frequently isn't. I ask a mechanic friend of mine, what is all that? And he said, I don't know. He said, we plug it in to a computer. The computer tells us basically what's working and what isn't. And then we kind of take what isn't working and replace it with another mysterious black box that does work.
Somebody someplace understands all of this.
They do. And there are still kids out there hot-rodding cars. But the way they're hot-rodding the cars, I mean, some of it is decorative, as it always was. But the primary way that they're taking these little Hondas and turning them into what they call tuners, very, very, very potent hot rods, is that they are reprogramming the car's computer. So they are plugging in to this car or changing chips in it or doing something with their laptop that I don't begin to understand. And bless them for doing it. But it ain't the old knuckle-busting, grease-in-your-hair sort of fun that my generation of kids had with a car.
What's your family ran a Buick dealership.
My family
near Toledo, Ohio, is that right?
In Toledo, Ohio. My family has been in the car business since before there were cars. Essentially.
Your grandfather worked on what he called buggies.
On buggies. My grandfather was a buggy mechanic. People now don't realize how complicated a good wagon, a buggy, or carriage actually was. They had a lot of moving parts. They had a very elaborate suspension. They had steering and so on. And Grandpa worked on these, and one day a horseless buggy pulled up at the shop, and he worked on that. And it didn't take Grandpa long to figure out that there was more money to be made and cleaner hands to be had selling the things rather than repairing them.
How far back is that?
We're talking about, my grandfather was born in 1877.
Uh-huh.
He went to work, he had a fifth grade education. He went to work as a boy of maybe 12 or something. So we're talking about the 1890s. And one of the first cars that he sold was a Willys. The company would eventually make Jeeps, and the company is still in Toledo, Ohio. Hmm. And my grandfather is said to have sold the first Willys in Toledo. And he went on to have a Willys dealership and a number of other dealerships, and it was Buicks by the time I was born in the 1940s. And we all worked there, everybody in the family. Me too. That was my first job. And the dealership was in our family. My cousin Hep sold it during the first Arab oil embargo during the 70s when dealerships went from being these little downtown operations to the big suburban.
I bet you and I differ on we're much the same in our politics. We're not the same in terms of our writing skills. You're the funniest writer I know. Except another guy who's much like you and who's a neighbor of yours, and I determined that you haven't met him. You and Mark Stein remind me each of the other.
I find Mark Stein to be a kindred spirit when I read him. I have never met
both
the man.
He and you live up in New Hampshire.
We do, but we actually live about an hour and a half apart. Yeah. New Hampshire is not a state easily traversed.
I have to arrange to bring you guys together.
I would love it.
I'm equally fond of both of you and of the writing that you do, and there are points of similarity. That is high irony, great humor, considerable self-revelation, and idiosyncratic perceptions, which are always right on the mark.
But you know, Mark
and both of you turned out to be quite conservative as well.
Very, very much so. But Mark Stein's got one thing that I do not have. Mark Stein has met everyone.
He's been around a lot.
He has been around a lot, and I don't think he's any older than I am, if he is as old. But at any rate, he did a wonderful series for The Atlantic. For some reason, they're no longer doing it. I don't know why. They ought to have their heads examined. He would do an obit every issue.
Oh, yes, and he then did a volume of the obits, and we talked with him about it one night right here.
They were wonderful.
Very funny.
But it always turns out he'd met the person.
Absolutely.
Or at the very least, he'd met the person's child or the person's mother or something.
Give me problems, sir, as you always do when you're here. I run late on commercials.
Ah, well,
before we get back to the first batch of commercials, I was about to say, you and I are similar in some things, our political views perhaps, quite unsimilar in others, namely our skills, but also in our driving histories. You started very early. I, as a Jewish boy growing up in New York, a few decades before you probably, started much later. Didn't start until I was, I think, already a PhD.
On my first job at
Yale in New Haven, Connecticut. I want to talk about early driving encounters.
Absolutely.
As we return right after we pause for this.
So make a date today to see the USA. See it in your Chevrolet.
Traveling east, traveling west.
I just asked you, do you remember that? And of course you do.
Oh, absolutely.
Identify the singer.
That was Dinah Shore, and that was for her own show. Chevrolet was a sponsor. And in those days, entertainers didn't think that it was beneath them to sing the theme song of their own advertiser.
Or even work it into the opening line. Jack Benny used to say Jell-O again when he was sponsored by Jell-O.
I thought that was like a cheerful, good-natured recognition of the fact that we are in a business, darn it, and they ain't no free lunch. And here's your sponsor. And let's back them up.
Now, memories of first car. When did you do your first driving?
Oh, I don't even remember. When I was five or six, my father would put me on his lap and let me steer. And he really would let me steer. I mean, down the highway. He would take his hands off the wheel. And he'd operate the pedals. I couldn't reach them. And I really don't remember learning how to drive. I remember some specifics. I remember learning how to parallel park and things like that. I remember learning how to stick shift. But I don't remember learning how to drive. It was something one just absorbed by osmosis. And I could drive long before I was 16, and I had a car, in fact, before I was 16. This is the opposite of the urban
experience. What was your first car?
A very embarrassing automobile. It was my grandmother's 1956 Ford four-door custom sedan in salmon pink. Mm. There was nothing you could do to me. I took the hubcaps off and put moon discs on the wheels. That didn't look cool. I jacked up the front and lowered the rear. That didn't look cool. There was nothing you could do to make that car look cool. Of course, now I'd love to have it, but that's nostalgia. In 1960, whatever it was, 64, whenever, 63, whenever it was, 63, when I turned 16, that was a pretty darn embarrassing car.
My first car, as I say, was acquired when I was a good... I suppose 25 or thereabouts, after getting my full graduate training and going off to my first job at Yale, bought it in New Haven. It was also a Ford Could it have been a Fairlane? Was that the name of an
Fairlane early model? Was certainly Fairlane was actually kind of the top of the line, named after Henry Ford's father's farm in Ireland.
Oh, I didn't know. I never knew.
Absolutely.
That.
And Fairlane Farm is still there. The house is gone, but you can still go to see the site of Fairlane Farm. Yeah.
But we just didn't drive in the world I came from, which was Brooklyn, and then, well, then to be sure, various Campi, Wisconsin, and Ann Arbor.
Well, even college campuses are mostly walkable. I mean, it's the European model, so far as it exists at all in America, is largely limited to a few big cities, really New York, and college campuses.
But the automobile meant a great deal in your life. It's conditioned and organized a good part of your adolescence.
Well, for one thing, I'm from the Midwest, and Toledo, although not a huge city, probably about 300,000, 350,000 when I was growing up, was enormously spread out.
Mm-hmm.
And it had suburbs, city suburbs, like the ones we lived in, which were actually inside the city limits, but they were nonetheless suburbs. And then, of course, it had proper suburbs, suburbs that were outside the city limits, and then people who lived in what we would now call exurbs. Plus, almost everybody had some kind of little lake cottage or little summer getaway someplace that they would also be driving to. And Toledo was not the kind of place that lent itself to a viable public transportation system other than sort of rudimentary bus routes.
It is a sociological platitude, or an historical one for that matter, that there were some four or five major forces that induce general social change. One is war and invasion and so on.
Yeah.
Another is climate change of a very severe variety. Yet another is technology.
Yes.
You are a serious sociological theorist, even though you eschew that title and that style. Indeed, you have some contempt for the style. But in fact, you have a great deal to say in this book, the new book, Driving Like Crazy, about what the automobile did to our way of life.
The automobile shaped the United States. We avoided the European social democracy model, the very high taxation, very intrusive centralized government control, heavier bureaucracy and dependence on central government, the welfare state. We avoided that in the United States largely by having something that sociologists call horizontal mobility, which means that you may not be able to get up, but you can get out. And some would argue, and me among them, that the United States started with horizontal mobility. After all, how we all get over here on this side of the Atlantic? And what is the Declaration of Independence, after all, except the demand from King George for the car keys? You know, it's we're out of here. Goodbye. We're gone. And so Americans... And this is particularly notable at the local political level. Americans faced, as the cities grew with the Industrial Revolution, Americans faced increasingly corrupt political machines in the cities. We faced declining quality of public schools. We increased criminality, increased bureaucracy. And we responded to these things not by having a big political fight in the European style, but by getting out of town. Those who were able left. The people with whom you grew up in Brooklyn moved to Levittown. The people inside the city limits of Toledo moved out to Sylvania, Ohio, or Perrysburg, Ohio, suburbs of Toledo.
And it changed what sociologists of an earlier era used to call courtship rituals.
Yes, that it did. That it did indeed. When I say that basically there was no premarital sex before the internal combustion engine, because your parents were always home, so you couldn't bring a girl over and take her, you know, into the rec room because your parents were home. They're working on the farm. They didn't have the capacity to commute any place to work. And then also your farmhouse didn't have a rec room because recreation hadn't been discovered because everybody was working too hard on the farm. There wasn't any recreation. Now you could now and again you could take a girl out in a buggy, you know, on horseback, you know, her horse, you know, drawn buggy. But you know, the two of you are sitting there spooning, you're facing the hind end of a horse. you know. And I tell people, anybody who thinks that the automobile creates greenhouse gases and the horse doesn't, hasn't spent enough time behind a horse.
The hide edge of a horse is not conducive to
romance.
To romance.
No, it spoils the atmosphere. It spoils the atmosphere.
But the back seat of a car is.
Back seat of a car is much cozier.
Possibly even the front seat.
Possibly even the front seat. And, I mean, just the fact that you could get out and away from the grown-ups, from the parents, and, you know, you could go out to, you know, some local spot to watch the submarine races or whatever it was, out to some local lover's lane, allowed kids to, well, shall we say, get to know each other a lot more easily than
and
they
somehow
could.
From that time to this time, the rate of marriage and family formation in this country has gone down considerably.
Yes. Well, so we're not going to say that all these effects were good, or if they were good, some of them were of the short-lived good variety rather than the long-lived.
As the French don't say, plus ça change, plus ça change. The more it changes, the more it really changes.
Yes. Well, in this case, yes. If you're going my way, well, I want to drive it all night long. Sometimes they wife.
Zach was just saying, I was asking you, what song is that and who
and we didn't
who's
know.
Singing it? He didn't know. And he was
he didn't
saying,
know, and he's a kid.
He was just saying that was chosen by three interns ago.
Three interns ago.
Yeah.
It's an interesting way of measuring
But the song
time.
Is Life is a Highway.
Life is a Highway, yes. And I'm afraid we've run out of places to run.
But you had some great adventures on highways.
I did.
And we got some great articles about
this
those
is
adventures.
As much as anything else, this is a travel book. It's not just about cars.
And let's go on some of those trips.
Well, one of the first ones I took, and actually it was the first car piece I ever wrote. I was writing at the National Lampoon. I was the managing editor of the National Lampoon back in the 70s. And I knew some guys from Car and Driver magazine because I used to drink at the same bar they did, right in my neighborhood. And we used to, and they knew what I did, and they knew that I wrote and that I liked cars. And they knew that I liked Buicks. And one day they called me up and they said, we've got this 56 Buick. It's sitting in Florida. And it needs to be out in Los Angeles. Do you want to take it for a drive? Well, it turned out that car had been sitting there in that garage for about 15 years. We had to get the mice out of the carburetor, and everything was wrong with it, and it broke every single day, and it wouldn't go fast enough to go on the highways. This is 1977, and so in the middle of the summer, the car was overheating terribly, and having vapor lock in the carburetor and all sorts of other problems that you never hear about in a car today. And we met every shade tree mechanic between Crescent City, Florida, and San Bernardino, California. We met every guy with a wrench and no teeth for the entire. It was quite an introduction to the American backwoods.
What was the road you went on?
They were all blue highways. They were all the secondary roads because we couldn't go fast enough to get on the turnpikes. And so we saw all these little towns. And, you know, 77, the South was still the South in those days. As I said, I think in the piece, they hadn't even evolved far enough to become Republicans yet. You know, it was primitive down there. But everybody loved that Buick. I had an English photographer who had kind of long hair and a sort of fruity English voice. And, of course, I'm this kid from New York, I'm from the Midwest, but I was living in New York, obviously Yankee kid. But that car, not only did that car break down every day, but it also saved our lives. Because every time somebody would see it, they'd say, oh, I have one just like that. You can't break those. Yeah, they'll go forever, except for ours. And so that was wonderful. I drove from, not too long ago, it could still be done. I drove from Islamabad to Calcutta across Pakistan and India.
I love your account of that particular trip.
That was
what was the occasion that sponsored that trip?
Land Rover had introduced the Discovery 2 model. It must have been summer of 98, because my little daughter was 6 months old, and I was afraid she wouldn't remember me when I got back. She did. But the and so they called me up and they said, we're going to introduce this model by driving two of them around the world. Not the water part, of course. They're going to ship across the water part. And they it was, you know, still the Pax Americana. It was the fall of the Berlin Wall, the era of good feelings, middle of the Clinton administration. And they drove that car from London all the way back to London around the world. And they said, what leg would you like to do? And I said, well, what about India? I've never been to India. And they said, well, meet us in Islam. We're going to drive down through Pakistan, cross over the Indian border. Nobody was allowed to cross the Indian border, but Land Rover somehow arranged this. And we're going to drive all the way to Calcutta and put the
That's vehicles. All across northern India.
It is the Grand Trunk Road. It is Kim.
Celebrated by Kipling.
Celebrated by Kipling. And it is, in fact, we started out from much the same point that that the book Kim begins at. And that road has become no less busy. He called it the Great River of Life, and it is that and then some. And, I mean, people live in the middle of the road. It was, and the wrecks were, the Indian truck driving is a scary, scary thing. And we had a pool in the car about how many fatals we'd see in a day. And I think the winning day, the high-scoring day, was over 25 fatal
dead bodies.
Well, the wreck had to be dramatic. We didn't stop to check always, but the wreck had to be dramatic enough as to have likely caused loss of life. Mere fender benders didn't count, and collisions with sacred cows, and or even collisions with non-sacred elephants, anything like that. This had to be a real smack up, crunch up wreck, and there was one day that we saw more than 25 of these.
What sense did you get of the Indian way of life down on the road?
Well, it was at first it seems just absolutely, utterly chaotic. Mm-hmm. And then you begin to realize that the reason this is so chaotic is the rapid growth of the Indian middle class. Even back in the 90s, this was going on. India, over the past 20 years or so, has been producing as many members of the middle class, relatively speaking, of course, relative to India, every year as exist total in the United States. They've been generating that many members of the middle class. And what happens is when they become middle class, the Indians buy cars, they move close to the road, and the charm of India is lost, and it's incredibly chaotic, and you get really angry at it, and you go pull off the road, and you go just a few miles down the road, and suddenly you're in rural India the way it has been for millennia. And that is so beautiful and so peaceful until you realize that those people are starving. They're selling the brides. The little girls are being sold as brides at age 8. There are murderous caste conflicts going on out there. And once you realize this is all very pretty looking, but once you get past your Mia Farrow moment where you think this is all spiritually wonderful, and realize what's actually happening out in the Indian countryside, you want to get back to that chaos and the stink and the dirt.
That would be a Farrow moment. Is that Mia Farrow and the and what are the gurus?
No, that was one of the Woody Allen wives. You'll recall.
Oh, to be sure, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean that was yes. She went through her mystical moments. I think, or I just pick her as a, you know,
not
all actresses seem
not
to go through.
Maharaja Mahesh.
Oh, Maharaja Mahesh Yoga, whatever it was. The Beatles fame finally died. I thought he was immortal, but never mind. He was reborn as something. I hope it wasn't as a
of course, you get driving adventures even in America. There are strange things happening in strange places.
Oh, we took a great drive from the Canadian border to the Mexican border. Again, these often have to do with product introductions. Jeep introduced the original Cherokee back in the 80s sometime, and they decided to do as a promotion to see if you could drive from the Canadian border to the Mexican border off-road, never put wheels on pavement. And they sent a bunch of teams out, and my team was me and Michael Nesmith, one of the monkeys. Although Michael's been a very successful businessman since then, but he'll always be saddle being with one of the monkeys, and he's a great car lover. But what the idea was that Jeep would send a team of two people And they would send a referee with us to see how many miles we spent on the road and how many miles we spent off the road. And you got 4 points for no road and 3 points for grassy road and 1 point for a gravel road and I don't know, you know, no points for a highway. And we had this friend, Renault had a major investment in Jeep in those days, so we had a French referee in our Cherokee with us. And Michael and I decided, the heck with this off-road thing. What we were going to do is we were going to take this Frenchman on a road trip. We were going to show this French, upper-class French business executive what the American road experience was like. Terrifying motel wall art, horrifying American road food, strange American roadside attractions. Mm-hmm. I think we got no points. But we had a very we had a better educated Frenchman at the end of this, and a rather disturbed
one. You have quite a love for those aspects of American roadside culture, things that we're supposed to be ashamed of. You actually revel in them.
Well, I do, because it is ordinary people getting to do what the heck they want. Yeah. It's like if we go back to India, it is, you know, there's nothing quaint about the main road through India, and there's nothing quaint about India's cities. I mean, everybody who's seen Slumdog Millionaire knows this. But that chaos is the product of ordinary people rising above their traditional situation and getting to do what they want.
But you find that on American roads, if you run into a water slide, that's great. If there's a Kentucky Fried Chicken, that's a monument to our culture and so on.
Of course. You got to love it all. You know, I mean, uh-huh. and because it just represents so much freedom and so much opportunity. And if it also represents some bad taste, well, what would you rather have, some bad taste or an unbreakable caste system that makes you be nothing but what your parents have been for 100 generations?
There's a good deal to be said for bad taste. It's the taste of the people.
It's invigorating.
As Carl Sandburg would have said, the people, yes.
Yes,
the people.
It is the taste of broad shoulders and broad tummies, too, you know, but oh well.
Speaking of broad tummies, maybe there's a food advertisement, maybe not, but pause for these words.
I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again.
Don't you think, PJ, in a way, that very song, Willie Nelson, that sort of captures the special joy that automobiles make available to you?
That's horizontal mobility.
That's horizontal mobility,
and,
ultimately.
The subtext to that song is that once I get back on the road again, you can't grab me. You know, I'm out of your reach. And some of that's personal, but hey, some of that's political, too. You know, you can't.
Now, speaking of things political, we come to the serious stuff.
Yeah.
How do you feel about government motors?
I am just furious about this.
Instead of General Motors.
I'm just furious about this. If I wanted GM stock, I would have called my broker. You know, I'm furious on a lot of different levels. First place, honestly, Barack Obama does not understand a damn thing about economics. And I'll prove this.
Governor, you're speaking about the profit.
Yes, I know. And I know I'm in Chicago. I know. But I'll prove this to you. First black president, Harvard Law Review. He could have joined the firm of DeBoeschu, Fitzgin, Lowell, Cabot, and God, made partner in half an hour, and you know, specialized in something like debt restructuring. He could be making a fortune off of every fortune that's been squandered in this country, and he could be doing the country some good with the millions of dollars of taxes he'd be paying, and instead he's living over the shop, running some shoddy business in a frankly suspect neighborhood of Washington. The guy knows nothing about economics.
Prove that.
I think I just did. But the other
thing
is...
But he's got the former president of Harvard advising him.
Yes.
Larry Summers knows this.
Yes, Larry Summers. Larry Summers. I guess all the diplomatic slots were filled, Larry being such a wonderful diplomat.
Well, Larry was once Secretary of the Treasury under Bill Clinton.
Under Bill Clinton. Say no more. The other thing is that if Obama had read something besides left-wing law, he would know about Schumpeter and the creative destructive forces of capitalism. When a business ceases to be able to make a product that anybody wants to buy at a price they want to buy it, it is time for that business to fail. The secret of capitalism is not success. The secret of capitalism is failure.
I should point out to our listeners, some of whom may not know, that a recent book that you did was about Adam Smith.
It was.
I think you titled it The Wealth of Nations. Did
it
you
It was
not?
On The Wealth of Nations.
On The Wealth of Nations.
I read the whole darn thing, plus Smith's theory of moral sentiments and pretty much everything else that Smith ever wrote and a lot of what his buddies wrote. And it's the roots of modern capitalism. So I'm a little bit of an economic, I don't class myself as an expert, but I'm a little bit of an economic hobbyist. And it is, I mean, when you keep businesses going, even though they are unprofitable and nobody wants the product that they're making, what you get is the Trabant automobile from East Berlin. What you get is what everything looked like east of the Berlin Wall back in the days when the Berlin Wall was still standing.
But the new American car, given the directives that have come from the White House, will be a green car.
Oh, well, that makes it okay.
It will follow the environment. It will help us save mankind and save the earth in the mode of Al Gore.
Even assuming the earth needs saving, which I happen to think is a big assumption, a leap of faith.
You mean you have some skepticism about global warming?
I am. Well, let's just say I live in New Hampshire, and we're all in favor of global warming. And I checked
get the chill out of the air.
You get the chill out of the air. And I looked at my topo map. I've got 1,100 feet of sea level rise before I get beachfront.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I'm a little skeptical about global warming. But let's just say for the sake of argument that there is such a thing as a need to combat global warming. Let's look at the wonderful record of the government in combating global warming already with ethanol, a fuel made out of corn that, first place, is driving up food prices in a world where food is always short for a lot of people. Secondly, causes more pollution in the growing and the milling and the refining than oil causes. And third place, tastes almost as bad as oil does with vermouth and an olive. I mean, this is the government saving the... and so why on earth should we listen to the government when it says it's going to make green cars? And then what's the government idea of a green car going to be? What's the Pelosi-mobile going to be like? You know, is this alternative-fueled, sustainable, small carbon footprint? Sounds an awful lot like what I called a Schwinn when I was a kid. You know?
But those guys got themselves into big trouble in Detroit. Chrysler and General Motors and Ford, which has not yet been taken over by the government, is also floundering with a vast load of debt. What went wrong?
Well, you know, maybe nothing went wrong. Maybe nothing went wrong. Maybe the time of the huge automobile company has simply come to an end. For many years, automobiles could depend upon a number of stable factors, pretty stable commodity prices and the materials that went into building the car, pretty stable commodity prices in terms of the oil that was necessary to fuel the car. They had to worry always about volatility of consumer demand, but every company has to worry about that. But being small and flexible was no particular advantage to an automobile company. There were greater advantages from the economies of scale. But starting in about 1970s, we began a great volatility in three different things. Four things, really. We had the volatility in consumer demand that we've always had, but we started to have a volatility in commodity prices for the materials the car was made out of, the enormous volatility in fuel prices, and then a new fourth kind of volatility, which is a volatility of government regulation. All of a sudden, all sorts of new regulations were being applied to automobiles. Some of them good, maybe. Some of them maybe not so good. But what they all were definitely was unpredictable. You couldn't tell what the next government regulation was going to be. And the car companies went into shock. And frankly, the products built by American car companies from, say, the middle 70s all the way through the 80s for at least 15 years or maybe 20 years were really not very good products. Now, at the same time, these are aging corporations. And these corporations were struck by another problem, definitely definitely not of their doing, a problem of demographic revolution. When the benefits packages that were put in place for the unions, when the union contracts were negotiated and all the health benefits and retirement benefits were set out for the union members, union guys were supposed to retire at 65 and a couple of years later drop dead at the bowling alley, you know, keel over from a heart attack. Their wives would live on for a couple of years more, and then they too would keel over, and the benefit package would that'd be an end of it. Well, all of a sudden, these guys are living to be 95. So these benefit packages and then health care costs, which had once consisted of, an occasional doctor office visit and a little bit of penicillin or something, all of a sudden, these guys are getting heart transplants, they're getting kidney transplants, they're getting liver transplants, nose transplant, feet transplant. Medical costs go through the ceiling. People start living forever. And these older companies who've been around for a long time find themselves with a kind of comet trail of economic burden, you know, behind them that newer companies like Toyota didn't have. Toyota's wages aren't lower necessarily than American wages, but their workforce is younger, and they don't have the...
So I'm playing along with that in that I shifted from a General Motors car to a Toyota car. The Lexus is Toyota in origin.
It is, and
we're buying,
and you did.
We're buying German and Japanese now,
yeah,
rather
well,
than American.
Maybe not so much German. I mean, German's still pretty much the luxury end, except for Volkswagen. Mm-hmm. But the Japanese have done a couple of things right. Now, I like Japanese cars. I'm not excited by them, but I admire them. Increasingly, the American car, partly because of the amount of driving that we have to do in our ordinary lives, increasingly the American car has become an appliance. And the Japanese are simply building better appliances. Mm-hmm. They're also able to, for reasons that are not the fault of American car companies and are not the result of any genius in the Japanese companies, able to do it cheaper.
More to be said about all of this, and we are, again, as usual, late for an obligation, and an important one at that, namely the update on the news, and for that, to Jim Gooden.
She said, baby, it's understood, working for peanuts, it's all very fine, but I can show you a better time, baby, you can drive my car.
And you know that one better than I do.
Yeah, that was the Beatles. Specifically one of Ringo's, usually it's Paul or John, yeah. Occasionally George, but that was a Ringo song sung by the Beatles.
Now then, before we go to the phones, and indeed I should at this moment invite telephone calls, the lines are open, the number 591-7200 as usual, 312-591-7200, and any thought or question you've got, any question directly to P.J. O'Rourke, any thought about the cars as they used to be and what's happening in the world of automotive achievement and automotive transformation and maybe automotive decline, we'd love to hear from you. And for that matter, share memories of cars as once they were. 591-7200, the number. If you want to reach us via email, if you're an internet listener at some greater distance, our friends in Australia might want to tell us about driving in Australia these days, or in Japan, or Malaysia. You look a little confused by that.
I am.
Well, on the internet, we reach the Pacific Rim more readily because it's noon there, and or one in the afternoon, depending upon where.
I was just in Australia, as a matter of fact, and took a very nice drive out from Sydney to Canberra, and out from Sydney up into the Blue Mountains. Beautiful.
But you weren't listening to us on the internet.
No, I wasn't. I confess.
So if you're up very early in the morning in London and want to get to us, wherever you are listening on the internet, if you want to reach us, the proper way is, of course, via email. The email address, extension720@tribune.com. Extension 720, one word, at Tribune, TRIBUNE.com. A minute or two, and then on to the phones. For that minute or two, I just want to engage in some sheer car buffery. That
sure.
is to say, when you think back on all the cars you've driven, all the cars you know about, what tugs at you nostalgically? What, for that matter, would you love to be able to buy and put in your garage, whether you drove it or not?
Oh, I think that my ideal automobile would probably be a mid-50s Alpha, one of the little coupes or one of the little Spiders. Just a beautiful engine, perfect balance, very light.
Now, an Alpha, is that the Italian?
Alpha Romeo.
Alpha Romeo, you're talking
the
about.
The only problem with these cars is that they were not exactly reliable or durable. But in terms of the beauty of the look, the feel, the right amount of power for the right amount, the right size of car, those things are great.
You talk about European cars. Do you remember the ultimate putt-putt, the... the Peugeot de Chevaux?
Oh, absolutely! Yes,
did you know that one?
Yes. Two horses. Two horses. Or more. Usually, when you saw one out in the country, it'd be two pigs that they would have stuffed into the thing. I mean, miserable little automobile that was. You know the.
I just learned the old Yugo was rather like that. I never actually saw a Yugo. But...
Oh yeah, I've driven a Yugo, and
have you?
you could just sit at a stoplight in a Yugo and listen to things fall off it. that was a government made car. That should give Obama some ideas. I think maybe we're headed for a green Yugo. You know, the things that fall off it will biodegrade.
I think we should go to the phone.
Sure,
so get your headset
not?
On. Volume knob below the table on the left.
Okay.
And we're going to begin talking with our listeners, many of whom want to join us. And 591-7200 is the number, of course. And I don't see any call at all because somebody's moved my screen. But we won't worry about that. We'll just go to number one. 591-7200, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, gentlemen. Yeah, sure, a midlife crisis story. I bought a new Corvette when they came out with a new model. PJ is probably familiar with it in 05.
Yes.
I now have an 08, and I was really pleased with the car. They downsized it, and I might add it gets over 30 miles to a gallon on the highway.
So what's wrong with the Corvette? You know?
Nothing.
Nothing.
And I get better mileage with my friends with Escorts, but I live in Lincoln Park. And I also had a Blazer at the time. And I'm driving to Lincoln Park. It's a beautiful summer day. And I see this gorgeous line on a bicycle. And there's eye contact. And I'm thinking, maybe I still have it.
Yeah.
He wants a mature man. And I'm on the phone. And she pulls up. And at this point, it's almost a religious experience. I'm praising GM.
Yes.
And she catches me the stop sign, she pulls up, and my heart is fluttering.
Yes.
I rolled the window down, and I said, "Hi, how are you today?" She said, "Jerk, you cannot talk on cell phones in Chicago anymore," which was...
She's going to make someone a wonderful wife, isn't she?
You've broken my heart. But I'd like to share one quick story related to your travels in India.
Yeah.
Milt, if you'll allow me, it's a semi, it's got to be acceptable. How do you know when an Asian family has moved into the neighborhood?
I don't know.
Even the Mexicans get car insurance. So, if you live in an urban area, you guys can appreciate that.
That is extremely politically incorrect.
I don't know.
But we absolve you.
We absolve you for it. That's right.
Your work, we can get away with it.
Yep.
All right.
And we thank you, gentlemen. I love the show.
And we pause for once on time and on cue for a quick round of commercials and then directly back on 591-7200.
Worn out suit and shoes, I don't pay no union dues, I smoke stories I've found, short but not too big.
This is really... There's no real justification for that, except I love it so much.
Hey,
Roger Miller says he's king of the road, but
wonderful songwriter.
But the road he's on is
actually a railroad.
He's riding boxcars.
Yeah, but that was the, you know, the railroad, because America had such a huge network of railroads, including what we would nowadays call light rail, small gauge, that reached into every town in America. Horizontal mobility actually preceded the automobile. Mm-hmm. The idea of the automobile actually preceded the existence of the automobile. I guess you could say that about Westerners and their horses, too. Mm-hmm. Americans always had this capacity to get up and get that I think was alien to Europeans.
And a great interpretation of our history is the frontier hypothesis developed by, what's his name, up at Wisconsin around the turn into the 20th century.
Right. And I'm thinking Frederick Remington. He's the sculpture, and that is, of course,
not
it.
Not Frederick Remington. But
anyway, it was in his the close of the frontier.
What defined America was, there was always a frontier.
It was the frontier. And I don't think that when the frontier physically went away, And there was actually there actually is a definition of frontier, and we still have some frontier up in Alaska. It is a, if I'm remembering this correctly, it is a population of less than two people per square mile. That is the frontier. Anything with more than two people per square mile is considered settled land, and the frontier is anything with less than two people per square mile.
We go back to the phones, 591-7200, and to Don in Crystal Lake. Good evening, sir.
Frederick Turner, wasn't it?
Apparently,
I'm sorry,
we lost Don.
But wasn't it Turner who had the...
Turner is the word.
Yes.
Turner is the man.
Turner's
he was
the man,
a professor at Wisconsin.
Yes.
And he developed the frontier hypothesis, which he presented at the Columbian Exposition in
here
in Chicago.
In Chicago.
In 1890, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And we go back to the phones, or try once again. Here's Michael in Buffalo Grove. Good evening, you're on
Hey, Michael.
Air.
Good evening, gentlemen. PJ, I'm a big fan. Of course, Milton, I'm a big fan, too, of yours. But PJ, your greatest quote ever, Republicans are the party that says government doesn't work, and then they get elected and prove it. Great quote. Love
yeah,
it.
We just came off 8 years of that.
Always love it. Hey, I'm going to suggest that there is a possible scenario to where the government owning a little bit of GM is actually a possible good thing for us.
Give it a try.
I'll try it. Okay. The government owns, governments own the roads, the highways, right?
Mm-hmm.
They've never owned the cars that go on the roads. So therefore, unlike the railroad that owns a track and the railroads, they don't own it. So there's never really been a good car that's fit on the roads and the highways. So my hope is that as the government, as the people have more of a say in the production of cars, that the advertisers will lose more of their, you know, of their effect. The profiteers will lose more of their effect, and that the good sense of people who actually commute for a living will start to win out. In other words, you could have a Maserati that drives 200 miles per hour, but when you're commuting, you're literally driving 20 miles per hour in Chicago. So the solution could be, and is proving to be, although it's a very small proportion right now, the solution could be narrow cars. There's a car called the Tango. Now, I know you can sort of snicker at it. It's not 100% romantic at this point. It is a narrow car. It's a tandem car with a seat in the front and a seat in the back. But the point is that commuters never have three people, and they're, I mean, 99.9% of commuters either drive one person or two people, right? So the whole passenger side of the car is not needed. And the metaphor is like if you went into a subway car during rush hour and you took up six seats, it would be highly inefficient.
Well, this is an intriguing idea, but you see, I think that this presupposes one thing that simply isn't going to happen, which is some sort of like creative solution coming from politics. Politics doesn't provide creative solutions. Politics provides mad compromises. So what you would get from if you tried to do a tandem car from government, there would be some like group of people, and I don't know who it would be, but they would come out of the woodwork that would somehow demand that you would have that you build a double wide tandem.
You stand with not merely with Jefferson, that government governs best, which governs least, but with Mies van der Rohe, who after all did say less is more. You think that's true in politics as well as architecture?
Absolutely. Actually, politics is the single least efficient method of achieving anything. We only have it here because there are certain things that simply cannot be privatized. As a young war correspondent, my first assignment was the Civil War in Lebanon. So I've seen privatization of military force. You don't want that. Societies need rule of law. They basically need government to provide three things, the most important of which are defense from exterior enemies and rule of law within the society. That is to say, defending us from strangers and defending us from each other. And then all governments, whether they should or not, it's a theoretical question I wouldn't want to get into, but all governments do provide some redistribution of income and resources. They provide some help to those people whom society deems utterly incapable of helping themselves and maybe of not having anybody who is willing or able to help them. All governments. So government has three roles. And the minute you take the government and assign it to any role other than that, you begin to see the true inefficiency. Anybody who's been sat in on a committee meeting, anybody who's been on any kind of committee, knows what kind of solution politics creates and at what speed it creates.
As a well-established conservative observer of affairs, political and social, I'd say you've got a very interesting 4 years out of you, maybe eight.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, this is great for me as a commentator and as a political reporter. I had a little lesson in this the other day. I was in a store, a little store in New Hampshire, and suddenly a local news crew rushes in. And I say, what's going on? They said, there's a big propane tank right across the way that sprung a leak. And I'm just sort of kidding. They didn't know I was in the news business. I'm just kind of kidding with them. I said, well, I guess this wouldn't be the moment for me to step outside and have a smoke. And they said, oh, sir, please do. We worship different gods than you do. And so that's true of us journalists. We worship different gods than you do. What's bad for people is good for us. Unfortunately, so do politicians also happen to, you know, Rahm Emanuel never let a crisis go to waste. They worship different gods than we do, too.
We're going to pause right now and take care of an update on the news. And then we'll be in the clear for more calls on 591-7200.
I'll show him that a limousine is not a car to scorn. Beep, beep. Beep, his horn went beep, beep, beep.
That's one I really don't know.
Yeah, that was a novelty hit about 1962, 61, when I was in high school. And the storyline runs that finally, as the limousine speeds up and the little car keeps beeping and beeping behind, finally the little car pulls up next to the speeding limousine and says, how do you get this thing out of second gear? I remember that to this day, for all these years.
That's not irrelevant and not unrelated to, I think, the content of the next call, as we go to Fred in Merrillville,
Hello,
Indiana.
Hello, Fred.
Good afternoon, or good evening, I should say, gentlemen.
Yes.
That's the Playmates. Beep, Beep was the name of that song. That's a great song. It brings back a lot of memories.
All right. Somebody else, obsessive compulsive novelty song rememberer.
Oh, yes. For me, I like to harken back to the days of the full-size sedans because I'm 6'5" and over 300 pounds.
And you just don't fit in anything they make.
Trying to fit into any of the new cars that they're building these days is just almost next to impossible. You either have the steering wheel up into your chest or your knees are up to your chin. And I love a couple of cars I used to have. I had an old 98 that had a 455 V8 in
it. Oh, yeah, I remember those, yeah.
And I had a Bonneville, a 76 Pontiac Bonneville four-door with the 400 V8 in it. And those cars were as comfortable as could be in both the front seat and the back seat. And
well, you know what you need? A guy your size, you need what I have is a Chevy Suburban. I mean,
okay.
that is a full, because it's a, that's a, I mean, I'm a little guy myself, but I've got three kids, three dogs, and a wife, and all the junk that comes with all of that. And it all fits. We can go all the way down to Washington, D.C. for a month and fit everything in there.
But, I mean, as far as leg room and things like that.
It's got huge leg room, yeah. It's
really?
Got huge leg room because I know this because there is something. It's got one of those automatic seats. It's supposed to seat. I kid my wife that she's got this, like, NBA basketball player boyfriend because one of the automatic seat things that I always hit when I get in the car, like, jacks the car seat back until it's in another county, you know, and I can't even reach the pedals. So I know it'll fit, and it's got tons of headroom. I can wear my hat inside with no problem at all. So, and that, of course, is always the other thing is ask the basketball players. Look what the basketball players drive, because I don't think they're getting into anything in the way of an Obama mobile.
Yeah, that's very true. So, well, I appreciate your suggestion there, and it's a great show. And Milt, keep up the great work as always. I enjoy all of your programs.
Thank you, sir. Very glad to hear from you. And let's go to John in Crystal Lake, who's on WGN. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Mr. O'Rourke and Dr. Rosenberg.
How you doing?
Good, good. Mr. O'Rourke, you're nostalgic with cars and the old great ones. Comes to mind designers like Harley Earl and Virgil Exner. These guys made cars you wanted to buy.
And Dara Zuntoff that designed the original Corvettes, another one to add to that. And Raymond Loewy that designed the beautiful Studebakers in the middle 50s. Yeah, one of the things that cars have always been for Americans, and I think they're ceasing to be now, is an expression of our love. You know, they say, you know, men don't love beauty. No, we love beauty. We love it on golf courses. We love it in automobiles. You know, maybe we don't appreciate it in paintings and furniture and interior design and jewelry. Maybe we don't appreciate that, but we do love beauty. There was an expression of the American aesthetic in automobiles, and it was an exuberant aesthetic. And everybody says, oh, ugly tail fins and big bumpers. Well, some cars did have ugly tail fins and big bumpers, but the better ones had beautiful tail fins and gorgeous bumpers. And this is gone. Everything looks like a Roland cell phone now, don't you think?
I think so, yes. I think the only current car that excited people was the Chrysler 300, and that turned out to be a one-trick pony. It never progressed.
That's true. And even then, you know, I mean, there are some good-looking cars out there. I like the new Ford Mustang. I like the Camaro. But that's a retro design. I would like to see some forward-looking stuff. Even with the foreign cars, there's a beautiful Maserati sedan out there. But it is kind of a retro.
Have you noticed that Ford essentially sticks to a retro design?
Yes, Ford's got kind of an old-fashioned design. It's a nice old-fashioned design. But the thing that was great during the 50s and the 60s was they were able to produce, like, new amazing designs. Mm-hmm.
Our thanks to the caller.
You're speaking of the Quattroporte, then.
Yes, I am speaking of the Quattroporte.
Sir, we thank you for the call. We have to run rather quickly. I must tell you that you've been wrong on something. Here's a critical email that's come in.
I shouldn't doubt it. I'm often wrong.
Brace yourself.
Yeah.
Hello, Milt. Great show as usual, but I must protest the misinformation given by your guest. Brilliant as he may be, his knowledge of the Beatles is somewhat lacking. Drive My Car was not a Ringo song. It was a Paul song.
I stand corrected.
How about that?
I think, though, that it embodies the spirit of Ringo.
And I'm told by Zach, four or five other people have called in to convey
there
that
are some
very
things,
information.
You know, when I worked for Rolling Stone, I found I could say anything. Of course, Rolling Stone could use any kind of language I wanted. And they didn't even mind my right-wing politics and stuff. But if I ever, in any way, said anything against Bob Dylan in anything that I wrote, it would just be the mail would just pile. Of course, in those days it was mail. The mail would just pile in, furious, angry. I couldn't say a single word against Bob Dylan.
And here comes the next caller, Mac in Chicago. Good evening, sir.
Oh, good evening, my pleasure.
How you doing?
I'm a so-called liberal, and I love your white ring position. I love it. I think you're right on Obama. I live a block and a half from him. Okay?
You're down there in Hyde Park.
No. No, a breed is a breed. Okay? A breed is a breed. I'm an old basketball player, played with the Goldschlager BC teams, okay?
Okay.
You're dead right. Okay? No?
Yeah,
thank you. He's in the mix, and he ain't saying a damn thing with black folks on the south side of Chicago that's been a damn thing. So you know that stuff he's talking about. He can talk about anybody other than he's not doing it. You know why? He's on the team.
He's only
at head of it, but everybody around him leads him. And when you understand that, I'm on the team. You know, when I call you and say, hey, you right wing, I'm left wing, but we're together, then all of a sudden we on the team. Okay?
Yep.
Okay, we on the team.
Yep.
Okay? We don't have to agree on every damn thing.
That's right.
Like in the Mac, what I'm doing, no. No way. Because the guys are saying the damn thing. I'm just so happy. And we got 845 guys in this city here. I'm 72 years old, retired civil structural engineer. Been in for 40 years. All right?
Yeah.
You are just fine. You and Tom Hartman are just fine. Okay?
Thank you.
We had a meeting the other day, and you and Tom Hartman were just the best.
Well, we appreciate that, sir. Who exactly is Tom Hartman? You don't know either. And we'll go on to another caller who may explain who Tom Hartman is. 591-7200, the number, as we go to Chris in Westchester. Good evening.
Hi.
Hey, Chris.
A friend of mine called me, and I guess you guys were talking about the history of the automobile.
Yep.
And I got into it a little late. I've been listening for about a half an hour.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think what's happening now in America, everybody's got on the bandwagon and is criticizing the United Auto Workers as if the problem was caused by them and their massive amount of money they take in health and welfare and stuff like that. The stuff they worked for and fought for years and years, where you get these foreign companies like Toyota and Honda and them guys, they come into this country just to beat our tariff laws, and to come into our country and sell their cars and build factories and not have a UAW in their United Auto Workers place. And what happened is that the problem with GM and them, they had all these legacy costs for all these.
Yeah, we pretty much covered that, actually. Yeah, you're coming in a little late. We definitely take your point there. And I don't think, you know, I come from Toledo, Ohio, totally a union town.
Sure.
I may be a Republican myself, but I don't blame the union guys. I mean, in the first place, you know.
It seems like everybody's leaning that way.
Yeah, they are, you know, but I mean.
I'll tell you the problem I think in this country is, it was the guys that were in charge of the car companies that made all the bad mistakes, going the wrong way with the size of the cars. They should have been more like Honda and Toyota and stuff like that.
Well, I don't know. You know, hindsight's 20/20, but you're right about it's certainly not the union's fault for demanding.
And I'd like to have a big car like you guys are talking about, but you want to know something? This isn't the time for that right now. I think what this country really needs is more nuclear power in here, so we get a lot more electricity and fix the grid like Obama's trying to do. And then once
I don't see Obama trying to do that. I mean, basically, I think if you
talking about is,
if, you know, I don't see it. I don't see it. If you believe that that you want clean energy and we got to clean up the planet, then you start up with the nuclear power. If you won't want to start up with the nuclear power, then you got to shut up, is my feeling. And I'm not seeing Obama coming out with that position.
Well, I don't think if we started using nuclear power for like power in our cars.
Well, not in our cars.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, the electricity from the nuclear power.
Well, yeah, that's okay. What I'm saying. If you want green, if you want green, you got to have nukes. If you don't want to have nukes, then you don't want to have green. So end argument.
But right now,
I'm not seeing that from Obama.
You got to have the infrastructure built up. You know,
I'm not seeing this coming from Obama.
I see him talking about that more than they're talking about nuclear, because you've got to have the grid first before the nuclear can come in.
You're not going to get any nukes from this guy. He's got all his lefty pals. Oh, Bill Ayers would blow a gasket if he went with nukes.
I don't think he's going to do it. But I think the next group of people, once the infrastructure has been improved,
maybe
his technology, you know, that he wants to, you know, run better wires and everything, which is the grid, and he wants to connect everybody better. And
maybe
once we get that electricity grid up
maybe
and running better, then once we get the nuclear power, we can revise the automotive industry with all these new plug-in
maybe
cars, and we can start.
I think he just wants more of your tax money.
Well, and then we can start the factory. Well, he's gonna want more of our tax money, but he's gonna run out because nobody's gonna be working. Okay,
there's that.
Once you get the people that can build the heat, where we can heat our home, and we got this very good nuclear power plants running and stuff like that, because, you know, Illinois is 40% nuclear our electricity comes from. The rest of the country is 20%. And I don't think a lot of people realize that. And I think that what will happen is once you get that clean energy going and he's got the grid built and the next generation of presidents, McCain.
No, maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. But I say that the Democratic Congress, Democratic president, say you get about 10 years from now, you're going to have no nukes at all. You know?
And with that, sir, we will thank you for a strongly felt and strongly expressed opinion as we pause for a last round of commercial messages.
Pretty blue lights along the way. Help you right on by. And the blue light shining with a heavenly grace. Help you right on by.
So our last musical bump of the evening, they've all been automotive connected, deals with riding up and down Lakeshore Drive.
Yes, indeed.
Just out the window there.
Yes, indeed.
You ever done that?
Oh, sure, of course, yeah, from the time I was a little kid. My mom's family is from Chicago. I lived a few years in Chicago when I was a teen, and this has always been my idea of a big city. And, you know, I moved to New York. In fact, when I first went to New York in the 60s, I was grossly disappointed by New York. And
really?
And I never was able to quite sum it up. And then years later, I was working with John Hughes, who would go on to make movies, and he was working with me at the National Lampoon, and John would fly in once a week to attend the meetings at the Lampoon. And John said one day about New York, he said, this would be a great city if they just clean it up and move everything back 10 feet. And, of course, that's Chicago. Chicago's, you know, New York, you know, with everything cleaned up and move back 10 feet.
You know I'm a native New Yorker.
I know you are.
We'd have some difficulty over that with it if we played it through. But right now we go back to the phones. 591-7200 as we go to Rich in LaPorte, Indiana. Good evening.
Gentlemen, how are you this evening?
Just fine.
We're well.
Well, that's very good. I hate to pick on you about your music, but the Beep Beep song?
Yeah.
That was actually a little Nash Rambler trying to pass a Cadillac. I don't know where that limousine thing came from.
You know, that's obviously a cover version. I was thinking the same thing. I think that was a Euro cover version because bubble cars, we never had. It was a Messerschmitt made you know, after they failed to make a successful airplane to win World War II. They made little bubble cars after World War II.
Yeah, what's frightening is I have that 45, so I know I'm right.
Yeah. I remember the Nash Rambler part, too, but I wasn't going to get into details. When the guy was able to name the group that played it, I was too impressed.
That was an accomplishment. But, you know, a couple observations real quick is I spent 30 years with the world's largest manufacturer of diesel engines, Cummins.
Oh, yeah, great company.
As a sales engineer. And what amazed me is we put millions and millions of dollars into the research and development of fuel-efficient diesel engines.
Yeah.
And the truckers put them in 379 Peterbilts, which is the most non-fuel efficient configuration you can buy. You know, that's the big conventional Peterbilt with everything square. There isn't a round corner on these things.
That's right, yeah.
So we beat our brains off to build these fuel efficient engines.
And they put them in rolling bricks.
Well, I mean, think about it. It's like going out in a 70-mile-an-hour wind with two sheets of plywood in your hand.
Yeah.
Very difficult to manage, you know, very difficult, but that's what they did. But no, my thoughts were this, and the only reason I gave you that is so that you don't think I'm completely crazy, but as we move towards the electric cars, is there anything going on with what I call the slot car concept?
Where it could hook in like a trolley.
You pull in, you pull onto the highway, you drop your pegs hydraulically into the slots. Everybody is in the same lane. You know, the two biggest causes for accidents is speed difference and lane change.
And lane change, yeah.
So now you're in the same lane. You can't change lanes. Everybody's going the same speed. You can sit back, relax, play with your cell phone, do whatever you want to do. Get to your exit, pull your pegs up, and off you go.
I think we're gonna wind up with that, but I don't think it's gonna be mechanical technology. See, I think we're thinking, you know, we're old. I think that's gonna be done wirelessly.
I
think this is what is going to, you know, the cars are going to send out a signal that are going to keep them at a certain pace at a certain distance from each other. I don't think you're going to need the peg in the slot in order to do this, but the concept is going to be essentially the same. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if you see that.
Our thanks to the caller. As far as I'm concerned, après nous la slot. I don't think I want it in my time. I've got to read you this. Here's an email from a guy listening in China, in Shanghai. He's David, who says he's a longtime listener and Shanghai and Chicago native, now living in Shanghai. Here's what he says. This show is great fun to listen to. You discussed the issue with U.S. car makers' legacy costs and how Toyota might not be paying employees more than GM. But Toyota's legacy costs are lower, thus resulting in more efficient cost structures pitted against heavy U.S. cost structures. What do you foresee for the U.S. auto industry when the Chinese brands, built by Chinese, making far lower wages and with different compensation structures, enter the U.S. market? I fear the worst is yet to come for the U.S. auto industry.
It may well be, although one of the things that we're finding out that the, I mean, one of the reasons that German and Japanese cars are being built and now Korean cars are being built in the United States rather than in their native countries is that shipping costs for something as heavy and complicated as an automobile, it's not like shipping sneakers, it's not like shipping stuffed animals. And so that you can afford to pay a much higher wage to make a car here than to make it with a low wage and ship the thing over here. So that's one of the great advantages. But, you know, you're right. I mean, China's going to come on with yet less expensive. India is probably even actually ahead of China in this respect. You know, heavy manufacturing, it's over in the United States. We have to go to a brain economy. You know, we can't pay people enough to do unskilled work in this country and not be underbid by other countries. That's actually a good thing long term, but of course it's going to cause painful short term dislocations.
We only have about 2 minutes left. You've had an odd career.
I have had an
odd
career.
Don't you think of it as odd or just as eccentric?
Oh, no, I do think of it as odd. All I've ever wanted to do is exactly what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it and get somebody to pay me for it. And
that's all worked out that way.
I've managed. I don't know why or how, and that's included writing about cars. You know, I've gotten to play with a lot of really exciting cars, and somebody's actually paid me to do that. And what fun! I've been extremely fortunate. You know, I feel sort of like Jimmy Buffett. I made a joke about Jimmy once. Jimmy and I are old friends. I made a joke about Jimmy behind his back one time. I immediately regretted it. I said, "God, if I'd only known, you know, how successful I would have learned three chords on the guitar." And somebody told Jimmy. Somebody told Jimmy that I'd said that. And I thought, and Jimmy was very funny about it. He held up two fingers, two chords. And I feel the same way. Like I somehow, you know, in the writing department, I learned three chords, maybe two, and have, as a result, have been able to go all over the world, do all sorts of different things, including lots of fun with cars. So,
just as a final note, it is the case that for a brief period in your life, in your youth, of course, you were a real left winger. Though basically,
I was a real hippie. I would say
a hippie lefty.
Yeah, I was a hippie. I was much more interested in the drugs and the girls and the and looking like a loony and doing, you know, again, doing anything I wanted. And of course,
it was drugs, sex, and rock and roll.
Drugs, sex, and rock and roll. And of course, the whole, you know, left wing politics came with the package. But when I began to get a closer look at left-wing politics at people like Bill Ayers, it began to dawn on me that this was even more totalitarian than the right-wing politics that I was rebelling against. You know, it was really the weathermen. It was Bernadine Dorn, Bill Ayers, those guys that scared the heck out of me. I said, this is disgusting. This is horrible. This is lots worse than being even a Republican.
And you wrote some fine stuff along those lines at some point, yeah. I guess, as you made that transition.
Yeah.
Back to...
Thank you.
To rationality.
Yeah, back to rationality.
And we've had a very rational, though I think a very laid-back evening with P.J. O'Rourke tonight. In case you didn't catch on, much of his stuff about cars and his adventures driving cars in strange, strange places is drawn together in a fine new book titled Driving Like Crazy. And that book is just published by whom?
By Grove Atlantic Press, my publisher since forever.
By Grove Atlantic. And with that, we'll close for the evening. With thanks to all for listening. Back tomorrow at 9. Until then, a cordial good night to all.